10987654321 10203040 with Emil Delitzsch, George Peros, Eliot Friedman.
I hope you pronounce them all like that too. 1 2 3 4 5 6 7
1 2 3 4 5 6 7 Marsupial. Marsupial.
Oh, nice. That's a new one.
You know what that's from? I think it was a Saturday Night Live skit with Tom Hanks, and he was like doing a radio thing, and that was his testing thing. He's like, marsupial, marsupial.
Welcome to our continuing summer series of podcasts. 31 Thoughts is brought to you by the next generation GMC Sierra Denali. And Elliot, we're going to rewind on this one, going back to the draft in Vancouver. And it is the Friday morning. We're at a hotel room in Van, and we're talking to the head of the Department of Player Safety of the NHL, George Peros. George, quick little bio, as we all know, Princeton grad, 9 seasons in the NHL, LA, Colorado, Anaheim, Florida, and Montreal. Should mention, never suspended. I know that raised eyebrows when that's always mentioned. Mm-hmm. Won the Cup in 2007, took the job with the Department of Player Safety in September of 2017, after Stefan Quintal stepped down. We spoke to him at the draft in Vancouver. Going into this one, what did you expect to hear out of George, out of Big George?
Well, the one thing I always like about him is that he's very deadpan, eh? He'd be a good card player. He doesn't give a lot away with his eyes or his face. Mm-hmm. He's very good at taking a question and not really giving you much of a reaction in terms of letting you know what he thinks about it emotionally. I'll tell you this. I know what he liked the most when he heard what your question was going to be about the car. He was very excited about that. He liked your question a lot better than any of my questions.
Are you going at him about Andrew Cogliano and that suspension?
Well, you know, like he had to know that was coming. And, you know, the thing is, too, is that that job, like you look at Stefan Quintal, that job took something out of Stefan Quintal. That job took something out of Brendan Shanahan.
I think that job takes something out of everybody.
It's the hardest job in the league. It took something out of Colin Campbell. It took something out of Brian Burke. It is the hardest job in the NHL because everyone's against you. Everybody thinks you're too soft or too lenient. People come after you because you're not good enough or you hurt them. You know, there's a great story, and the GM, he confirmed the story to me, but he said, you can't say it was me. But he screamed bloody murder. It was when Shanahan was the guy. He screamed bloody murder at one of his guys got run over in a big game late in the year, and he's like, you have to suspend that guy. You have to suspend him. And then he looked at the schedule and saw that the team they were battling to make the playoffs was going to be on this other guy's schedule. Yeah. And then he got mad because the suspension was too long. He was going to miss the game against. That's the way it goes. It's everybody talks a good game about safety, but also you want to bend it to your own personal wishes, right? How can it benefit your team? And so I think it's almost like a friendless job. And plus also, it's all lawyers, right? Like in the sense that you better be able to suspend for this, because if it's not this, here comes the appeal or here comes the dispute. I think it's a tough job, very tough job.
I like your point about it takes something out of you. And I always look at that position, the head of the Department of Player Safety in the NHL, as being in a fight with Ryan Vandenbosch. You may win, but he'll take a piece of you. That's the thing when Ryan Vandenbosch fought. He would always get a piece of you, and that's, I suspect, what it's like running the Department of Player Safety in the NHL. So there you go. There's the setup. There's the windup. Here's the pitch. George Peros on 31 Thoughts Podcast.
This is George Peros of the Ducks, and we're here in the locker room after practice day. New Year's Eve is coming up, and we're looking at some of the guys' New Year's resolutions.
For me or for you?
For both. How about for me? You can start with me. That's
well, for you, actually. For you, I'm thinking haircut.
I'm going to get my line mate, George Peros, to 15 goals.
Whoa! That is
drastic at the left point. As his shot blocked and off of the races, here's Peros. He's in on a breakaway. George Peros in, and he scores! Letton got a piece of it, and George has made it 3-1.
Oh, wow. What a huge goal for the Ducks. The fourth line chips in with a beauty. And here we go, a fight before the puck is dropped. Peros and Jansen throw the mitts down. The ninth fight in the season series. Peros leads the NHL in fights this year. His 22nd. And he is a good one. Now we've got a scrap. It's going to be George Perros and Brad Winchester. Oh, George Perros, Princeton. Brad, tough cookie there.
Here comes a fight at center ice.
John Erskine, gloves down.
Yep,
George Perros.
Right off the get-go.
We tell you that good news, and the smart guys, the Brainiacs, Westgarth, and Perros, they're going at it.
Sulzer gets it back and then knocked away. Weiss is in. Back pass. In front, Perros score! Big George with his first as a Panther.
Former NHL tough guy, that man right there, George Perros, is the new head of the league's Department of Player Safety.
Elliot, we're pleased to be joined now by someone we talk about quite frequently on the podcast. He is the head of the Department of Player Safety in the NHL, former NHLer George Perros. And George, I want to lead off with this. David Byrne's Once in a Lifetime song, Talking Heads, is a moment where he says, you know, you find yourself and you say, how did I get here? Do you ever turn to yourself in a moment when you're by yourself in reflection and you say to yourself, you know, I'm the guy, I'm the sheriff, I'm polishing the badge. How did I get here?
That's a good question, a good song reference too. I guess I have myself to blame for that. I hounded down Stefan Quintal pretty good for their gig in the department. When I was done playing, I always knew I wanted to stay in hockey. Did a number of things to try to try and get my foot in the door, and one of those was hounding down Stefan for a job. So took him some time, but he came around on me, and after 2 years in retirement, he brought me in the department. So started out working with him, and one short year later, he wanted to step aside, and I took over. So it happened quicker than I thought probably, but I'd been pursuing it for some time. I thought it was an area of interest in the hockey world that I might be able to make it.
I was going to start with a different question, but just a follow-up based on that, because just to keep the interview flowing properly, like a true professional would, that job, it takes a toll on people. And it took a toll on Stefan Quintal, and it took a toll on Brendan Shanahan, and it took a toll on Colin Campbell. Has it taken a toll on you?
Another good question. It does. The job definitely takes a toll on you. And you look back and say, you know, Coley did this for 14 years, I think, and that's got to be some sort of record. Brian Burke did it for a bit, too. You definitely need tough skin. You have to feel comfortable in your decisions. You take a lot of heat, and it does. It wears on you. So we're at the end of the season here. I'm happy to limp over the finish line again, like I say, but it's an interesting job, and more importantly, it's an important job. And I relish in that. It's never been a really fun one. You don't deliver a lot of great news, and a lot of people question your decisions, and that's what takes a lot out of you there. But, you know, you're trying to preserve the game and make the right decisions for the game of hockey, and so it's an important gig, and that's why, you know, it means so much and why it takes so much out of you, I think.
What was the toughest one, toughest moment you went through?
Toughest decision?
Yeah.
Well, I think that had to be the Cogliano one, yeah, for sure.
Ooh, and Kempe got hit up hot.
Here we go. That's... Yeah, now we might have four right here. We'll see. Looks like a line brawl getting ready to start. Well, here's Kempe entering the zone. Now it's late.
Yeah.
Ooh. You can see the head snap back.
Yeah, an initial point of contact you start thinking about there as well.
And you can see Adrian certainly took it in the schnoz.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, I think as... I don't really talk about too much as I've been going through it because, you know, you're in the process of it. But it's a tough pill to swallow. I'm not going to lie. You know, I played hard and I battled and I'm a professional and someone that I played a long time and I missed the game. So.
Cogs, I know this is tough for you, but how about the support of your teammates?
First year heading the department, I hit that was not so borderline when I look back at it, but, you know, certainly at the time seemed like, you know what, this is a guy who obviously doesn't do this sort of thing and had his Ironman streak going. He never really want to disturb anything like that and be a storyline in that type of way. He was a friend of mine and a former roommate, as you guys have probably read and reported, and very difficult, you know, but at the end of the day, I do have a job to do, and I want to make sure I'm making the right decisions, and I kind of learned early on, I'm the one that has to sleep at night with my own decisions, and if I can't sleep at night knowing that I did something that I shouldn't be doing, then that takes an even greater toll on you. So I felt that it was the right thing to do, despite the fact that Cogs had his streak going and everything else. It was an appropriate action for the hit, and that was the toughest one for sure.
Players were really upset by that one. How would George Perros, the player, have felt about that suspension?
See, here's the tough thing with this job. Everyone harps on us for consistency, right? It's the biggest thing. The first thing anyone says about the department, even officiating or anything like that, consistency. We want more consistency. That's a hit that if anybody else had made it, then they would have been suspended. It wouldn't have been that much of a story. But being a player, you don't want to interfere with a player's career in that way. But the consistent thing to do would be suspend there, because it really wasn't that. Borderline. Like I said, it was the right thing to do, and we take a lot of heat for that. I took a lot of heat for it, and I get it. I understand it. But at the same time, I am trying to be consistent, and that decision, a lot of playoff decisions we make, all sorts of decisions, everyone harps on us for consistency, but then they also want us to take it easy on Cogs because, you know, he had a streak, or this is the playoffs, and this shouldn't be something, or whatever the excuse might be of the time. You know, people want consistency, but then they fight back when it goes against the grain of what they feel in their hearts, maybe. Depends on, you know, which side of the fence you're on and who your loyalties lie with. But I know the decisions that are going to be popular or unpopular and who they're going to be unpopular with. At the end of the day, like I said, I have to sleep with my own decisions, and that's where you try and be consistent. Just take everything else out of it, look at the incidences, and go from there.
Are you and Cogliano good now?
I went around the fall tour this year, met with every team, spent a moment with him, shook his hand, and, you know, I think he probably won't ever be happy with my decision, nor would I blame him, but I'm fine with him. I think he's fine with me. It's not like, I don't know, I won't get a Christmas card, maybe, I don't know, but I never did, so it's fine. It's just, the moment has passed, and hopefully, at some point he understands that, you know, I was doing my job to the best of my ability at the time, and we go on from there.
Okay, let's lighten this up a little bit. Let's change it up a bit. Who wins an IQ test, you or Kevin Westgarth?
You know what? Probably Kevin. Just ask him. But Westy is a very smart individual, as was his brother. I played with his older brother at school. I never actually played with Kevin at Princeton. Certainly played against him more often. But he's a smart cookie, that's for sure. I wouldn't want to take that challenge, I suppose, but who knows? Never know. I've never taken an IQ test either, so I don't know if I'd be good or bad at it.
Well, wait a sec. Hold on. So, Princeton guy, I assume you'd be pretty good.
I'd be okay. I don't know. Yeah. But what can you say? It's been a long time since the book learning days, so I've been beating those brain cells out of my head for a while now.
Well, how about this one then? You referenced Brian Burke a couple of seconds ago, who did your job once upon a time. And I remember Brian telling me it's the worst job in the NHL, rather. Because every morning you wake up, everybody in the league thinks you're an idiot, thinks you're dumb. You're not on the same page with anybody. Obviously, everyone has different ideas. But you wake up every morning and everyone thinks you're dumb. It's especially bad in Montreal, where you're dumb in two languages. I'm curious where you would get any advice from, or how many people would you talk to either before taking the job, now that you have the job and have some track record with it. Is there anyone you'd ever lean on for advice? Like, hey, what do I do in this situation? What should I do here? What would you have done in this situation? Anyone like that for you?
Maybe it's more of a therapy session than anything. It's important to listen to different viewpoints from guys that have had the job before. And Brian Burke wrote me a real nice letter when I first took over the department, telling me his viewpoint on things and what to expect and things like that. He's always been a great mentor that way. And Coley, when I first took over, first of all, I had certainly a sit down with Stefan. That was easy because he was still working with us. But I made a point to call Brandon Shanahan and call Berkey and talk to Coley as well. So I just gathered all their viewpoints, took some things away from them that I felt were appropriate. But you know, when I'm in the thick of things and I don't really reach out for advice as far as making my decision, I have a team for that and a really good one at that. But in that process, you certainly glean a few things and you ask them, maybe not a specific incident, but, you know, take some things away from guys who've done it before. And it's always helpful talking to those guys and, you know, maybe throwing something against the wall. But it's never about a specific decision, maybe more of a big picture thing or an experiential thing that maybe something quirky comes up, you want to just get a take on it. But there's very few people have done this job, so there's very few people that can understand what you're going through.
Can you describe your team? The people that make
Damian's
these
been
decisions.
There like 20 years.
Yeah.
Been there. I mean,
there's another Burke there now, Patrick.
I'd love to describe my team because we get a lot of people, you know, who knows, the imagination races. It's like, oh, who's really making your decisions or what's all going on there and who are these people? They know there's non-hockey guys, non-former NHL guys in the department. my team's incredible. I couldn't do this job without them, and it's important to have different viewpoints, different vantage points, different past experiences. My team's comprised of Stefan Cantel, who ran the department for 3 years, worked under Shani for 3 years before that from the start of the department, so obviously played 18 years and 1,000-plus games. I hired Ray Whitney. I was very excited to do that. I wanted a guy who was a more skilled guy. He had left the game pretty recently as well. He had been scouting at the time and knew all the young kids coming up too, so was still really attached to the game, and he's a great resource for me as well. But beyond the NHL guys in our department, we have Damian Echevarrieta, who has been in the league for 20-plus years. He worked with Colin Campbell back in the day with the Rangers. He was doing this job when they were cutting VHS tapes and was, you know, around for the beginning of the department and the institution of Rule 48 and everything else. So he's the department historian. He's got the track record on everything going all the way back. He's has tremendous knowledge of the rule book, and he's just been there from the beginning. So it's important to have that type of guy as well. Patrick Burke, son of Brian Burke, law background, a really intelligent guy, knows all of the ins and outs of the game. He's been around the game for a long time, and he'll joke around that he was in diapers when Burkey was, you know, doing this gig and helping him suspend guys by watching VHS tapes and stuff like that too. So, you know, between the five of us, it's a really good crew, and then we got a lot of, you know, worker bees too that cut up video and stuff like that. But you know, our whole department's really fantastic.
So we know that Jeff would never do anything illegal. So let's just say there's a game happening and I run Jeff from behind. I plow him into the boards. I'm immediately tossed from the game. Okay. Obviously you guys are watching this. What happens from that point for you guys to decide, am I suspended?
So we'll get a clip if I'm not in the room that night, which is a lot of nights too, but Damien or Patrick are always in that room. They're running the room, and we've got guys dedicated to each game. And all night long, our coordinators will pull a clip to attention to Damien or Patrick and be like, what do you guys think? And it might be something clear and obvious, like Jeff running some from behind and through the boards, but they'll still be like, do you want this to go to the group or not? And Damien will be like, that's nothing. We don't need to send that out. Or he'll be like, I want everyone to see this. And it might be something as simple as a little slash to a hand or something like that. Whatever the case might be, if it passes the first test there, then it gets emailed out to our whole group. I'm on my email all night long, all day long. And during the course of games, as these clips come in, I'll figure out on my own accord which ones I want more thoughts on, which ones I want to examine further. I might ask the guys for thoughts on something that I know I'm not going to suspend for, but I want to see what their take is on it. But something clear and obvious like that too, I'll put out for thoughts. You know, what do you think? And each one of the guys, including the coordinators and everybody else, they will send me back their thoughts independent of one another. It's just an email to myself, and they'll give me the thoughts on the play. Well, I think it looks like this and blah blah blah, or it compares this, and I would do something, I wouldn't, whatever it is. They give me their opinion, and then at the end of the night or during the course of all this, you know, I'll form my own opinion and might take some cues from some of the guys. They might point something out to me I didn't see, whatever the case might be, but I'll be formulating my opinion. At the end of the day, I decide what I want to do, if I want to press forward or not. If it's something that's clear and obvious, and I'll reach out to a GM that night and be like, we should probably set up a hearing, blah, blah, blah. Sometimes, a lot of times, with some of these close ones we get, I'll be thinking about it overnight and want to see how I feel about it in the morning, see if anything's changed, get another fresh look at it, whatever else it might be. But that's kind of the process.
How quickly do you get calls from general managers?
Well, in general, they're not supposed to contact me.
Supposed to contact.
Yeah. There's a 48-hour rule that, you know, generally they're, I tell them too. I go, listen, if there's an issue like with, you know, operationally with your team, you're traveling, you're light on guys, or you might want a head nod or something like that. I never really know if I'm even going to suspend a guy till after the hearing. You know, a lot of guys think that we've made up our minds, and it's a guaranteed slam dunk suspension, whatever the case might be. But I don't like to fool around and waste people's time. I don't like to have hearings for no reason, but it doesn't mean you're automatically suspended. But I can give I might have a general idea, you know. So if a GM, you know, reaches out because there's an operational issue, I'll tell them that's fine. But, you know, they're supposed to leave us alone for lobbying reasons.
If a player comes in and sort of throws himself on the mercy of the court, look, I'm in for my in-person, I did it, my bad, brain cramp, throw it at me, sheriff. Does that player get more leniency for the honesty, or does it even matter?
It's refreshing when that happens.
What percentage does that happen?
It's refreshing when that happens. What we say is, you know, a clean record doesn't get you out of something, and that's no better example of, you know, a Cogliano-type suspension. We've had more since. But if you do something that's generally suspendable, then you'll probably get suspended. And if you have a clean record, clean as a whistle, never hit somebody in your life, and you made one hit, and it's a bad one, then even if you come to the court and say, you know, sorry, whatever, you know, we'll probably suspend for it if it's a suspendable offense. So having a clean record really doesn't help you get off too much, but if you have a bad record, then that's when we can pile on if we need to, depending on the specifics of the case, if you've had similar incidents in the past, if you're a repeat offender, all that other stuff. So that's generally where we stand on it.
For the training videos that you would put out, which player appears the most? And is the answer Colby Armstrong?
The training videos, like you mean, like the suspension videos?
Yeah,
the
ones saying, like, the ones you have up saying this is what you should look for on a slash or a high stick or something that. Yes,
those are actually all done before I got there, but they still ring true. That the one, our standard videos, is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Is he on there a lot? Is that what you're saying? Bringing this up?
He's been up a couple of different times for a couple of hits. Yeah.
Past the midpoint of this first period. Boynton had the right idea there. He had Van Riemsdyk hanging out at the Leafs line, but pass was blocked. And the Leafs go to work in the offensive zone.
In this example, the Philadelphia player makes a clean, hard, open ice hit. Unfortunately, the Toronto player was vulnerable due to shooting the puck immediately prior to the contact. In closing, as our game evolves, we hope to always maintain its physical nature while making the game as safe as possible for our players and exciting for our fans.
When I first started, I combed through all of those, and I'll have to go back now and have a good laugh at Colby because he probably is on there a lot.
Have you ever had an owner reach out to you? I know they're not supposed to, but it happens from time to time. And one of your predecessors did tell me that the time he got shook the most was the first time he had an owner directly reach out to him.
No, not directly out to me, but, you know, I do go to games. I am around. We have a lot of meetings. I'm on the circuit here with, you know, presenting a lot of different meetings, things like that. So I certainly have plenty of encounters with them. And that kind of bleeds back into the fact, like I said, I have to sleep at night when I make my decisions. Yeah. And so even if an owner approaches me, it's, you know, uncomfortable just because of the fact that you know, explaining yourself to an owner. But at the same time, I'm usually very comfortable in explaining my decision because I've come to peace with it and feel it's the right one. Sometimes on the more high-profile cases that I'll get, I'll send an email out just saying, you know, just so everyone knows, this is on the horizon. This might catch some attention, so, you know, we might be doing something like this, and, you know, if you get some questions, here's how we feel about it, et cetera. So.
What is the worst excuse you ever heard? You don't have to tell me who it was.
I wouldn't tell you who it was. Yeah.
But what was, like, when you walked out of a hearing, you said, I cannot believe that player tried that to get out of a suspension.
You know, it runs the gamut on excuses, but, you know, I got to tell you, we ask a lot of the players in this game. You know, the speed of the game is so fast. A lot of these things happen, and, you know, a lot of the suspensions we have, you're an inch off or a second behind or whatever the case might be. So I understand it's tough for these guys to avoid certain types of hits, and a lot of stuff isn't too intentional. So we get a lot of different range of excuses. So, but, you know, I think one time a player said that he wasn't looking where he hit the guy. He wasn't paying attention to where he was hitting him. And so when you think about it, I guess I get it, but it doesn't excuse you from hitting somebody. It's like, just because you weren't looking, if, you know, the biggest repeat offender in the game said, I just wasn't looking there, so it shouldn't be suspendable. It's not really a good excuse. So, I mean, things happen out there and it's tough, but yeah, no, there's no shortage of excuses, I suppose.
One thing I've always wondered about is why cowbells aren't suspendable. The play with the stick in between the legs from underneath.
Cowbells.
I've always just called it cowbells. Why is that not a suspendable offense?
Actually, that was part of the fall tour. I went around and talked to the guys talking about spearing and things like that we're going to start paying more attention to that. Because the year before in the playoffs, we had quite a few of them. It just led to a whole bunch of scraps and scrums. And you know, it's kind of incendiary out there. You do stuff like that. So we just told them we were going to be looking more for that. And I got to tell you, the players responded. We did not really see that much this year in that department. I did find one player for that. But in general, and I don't know specifically, it's because we were on, so we were looking at it. But I'll tell you, they did respond. We didn't see much of that this year at all. We still did see some. And if it's an extreme version, you know, sometimes you'll tap a guy and I don't have a force meter out there. It's like, well, this is suspension. This is nothing. So not every penalty is a suspension. Not every penalty is a fine. Some things are just penalties, et cetera. But I will give the players credit. Like, we didn't see half as much of that stuff this year, I don't think.
And is there any chance we can get cowbell into the Department of Player Safety vernacular anytime soon?
I can't officially support that, but I like the I like that. I hadn't heard that one before, so good on you.
Okay. The other one I wanted to ask you about this is we had Dave Andrews from the American Hockey League on our podcast, and he's retiring, of course. And he said he sees the day in the next little while where all hits to the head will be banned at the pro level. Do you?
You know, I got to tell you, I'll never say never. You know, this game's come a long way, and it's going in a very highly skilled direction. And I'd say if it's trending in any direction, it's trending in that direction. You know, we still try to preserve physicality in this game. It's we don't like to disrupt the good card clean hit. And at the end of the day, like I said, if it's going to tip one direction, it's certainly going in that direction. But So I won't say it'll never happen. I can't say that at all. For now, we try to do the best we can to protect the physicality in the game, but also, obviously, most importantly, protect the guys' heads in these shots that are creating concussions and things like that.
Let me try one more then.
Okay.
Is it on the radar? Like, does this come up for discussion much?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I think everyone kind of has in the back of their minds maybe, but it's always a viewpoint, I think, that's out there and everyone's kind of conscious of. But, you know, as far as the actual rule and things like that, we haven't really started to dig into that just yet.
I have a pet theory that Elliot's heard too many times, which goes like this. Zdeno Chara should win the Lady Bing every year, not for what he does, but for what he chooses not to do. Because if he wanted to, he could lay waste to the NHL. I'm just curious your thoughts on Zdeno Chara and players that you look at, George, and you say, if this guy wanted to, there could be a body count, but he doesn't. Your thoughts on Chara and those types
of
players?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, there's a number of them. I can name a few, you know, that you're absolutely like, well, if this guy had a mean streak, if this guy played back in the day or something like that, this would be trouble. So, yeah, I think that's a good question, a good viewpoint. Yeah, I mean, yeah, Big Z is a big man, and he could do a lot more damage if he wanted. So, certainly being the position I'm in now, I'm glad he doesn't.
So one of my memories of you as a player is when Anaheim won the Stanley Cup, and you're always a pretty stoic guy to begin with. But I remember, like, Solani's bawling, the Niedermeyer family is bawling, and you're walking around and you couldn't even tell that anything different had happened. How could you not be as emotional as all those guys were when you played in Anaheim and won the Stanley Cup? Because I covered that, and like, you were like, stone-faced.
That's funny. I haven't heard that before, but you know, my mom says I have a heart the size of a pea, so maybe that's it. I don't know. I guess I keep the emotions in, but there is no lack of emotions for me personally. I took the cup right when I got it in my hands. I took it right over the corner where my parents were, and it was really welled up pretty good, but I also did rub my mustache on the cup at that same exact time, so... I don't know what to tell you. That's funny you say I'm stoic, but I was just enjoying every minute of that one, I got to tell you. Have my parents there and everything else, and all the emotions washed through you. But, yeah, I guess I wasn't crying. I don't know. More cheerful at the moment, I suppose.
That's funny.
What did you think that moment that Daniel Alfredson took that shot at Scott Niedermeyer?
Around behind Rob Niedermeyer, had Paulson in front, dragged for Mullen, body position, couldn't get a good backhander going. And so it is Alfredson with five left in the period. Did Alfredson shoot that puck at Niedermeyer?
He did.
Yes, he did.
That's why they're going after him. You're darn right he did.
I mean, Alfredson, time was coming down. He looked at the clock.
Oh, there's going to be a penalty on Alfredson there, no question.
He shot the puck right
to me. That is absolutely inexcusable. He looked at the clock. He realized there was still about 4 or 5 seconds left, and he shot that puck towards the direction of Scott Niedermeyer. I hope Daniel Alfredson was not doing that on purpose, Pierre. You got a great view. I thought he was shooting it towards Scott Niedermeyer.
And I think he turns his body, he looks at the clock, and he fires it right at Niedermeyer. Niedermeyer's not pleased at 11. Look at how he changes his body. He identifies, and then it's
just
hand.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely.
Players know that. That's why Niedermeyer's all over Alfredson now.
That was Paulson. That was Samuel Paulson. That's classless.
I look back at that. recently, because there was some chatter. Something happened in the playoffs this year where there was a puck kind of shot in the direction of somebody.
I can't remember who, but we were talking about it on the show. That's right. Yes. What was it?
I mean, that came up.
I look back, I'm like, well, hey, the last time, you know, this happened, I remember I was on the team there, and I look back at it, and it's like, yeah, that one was clearly more of a shot towards, this last one wasn't so bad. I looked at it, I'm like, well, this isn't that last one with Scotty and Danny Alfredson, but that was a pretty directed shot.
If that happened right now, is that suspension?
Yeah, let's not go there. another tricky one, right? Sensitivities keep rising, right? And
what did Scott say in the dressing room after? Like, that was going into the intermission.
Yeah, very calming. That's Scotty to a T, though. Like, you know, we're not letting this bother us. We have got a job to do, and we're going to do it. You know, he brushed it off completely and talk about a stoic guy. Like, he's in the locker room. He doesn't say much. When he does, he speaks up, and everyone pays attention. But that was just wasn't even a concern, you know, and we were all really ticked off for him, obviously. But there's a bigger goal at hand, and that's the way to handle it, really. So he's a true professional, the greatest player I've played with, hands down.
You did hockey's toughest job. You were an enforcer. And there are always guys on teams who are bend over backwards to say, I appreciate what you do, and they always are thankful and take care of you because of it. Who were those guys?
I love playing with Sheldon Brookbank. Because I was a guy, you know, I obviously was one of those guys that would stand up for anybody on my team. I never really caused much chaos out there. I was the guy that hopefully prevented it. I wasn't someone that, you know, another player on another team would worry about, well, we got to watch out for George. He's going to, you know, wreck some from behind and it's going to be a whole mess. My whole deal was, you know, just make sure that doesn't happen to my guys. But being on a team like Anaheim that had a certain type of character and personality to it, no shortage of players willing to drop the mitts. Sheldon Brookbank was the best kind of running mate to have, because if somebody on the other team had somebody that ran around, did something stupid and was hurting guys or whatever the case might have been, take advantage of players who was a smaller player and would have been uncouth for me to go over and drop the gloves if someone was much smaller than me. Sheldon was in that next weight class down where I had all the big guys covered, and he had all the other guys covered.
Like Marty McSorley and Warren Reichel.
Pretty much. So I never had an issue, because at that point, there was nobody that wasn't going to get, you know, face the music for something they did out there. And I knew I didn't have to deal with all those guys. And he was the best in that weight class, pound for pound. He would fight anybody. Just like any number of guys you could name in the history of hockey who gave up a lot of weight and size, and I respect every one of them to fight bigger and tougher guys. Sheldon, you know, had no problem fighting up my weight class, but certainly handled his own in that weight class. It was just a nice running mate to have. So
Gary Howitt was that guy with the Islanders. As you're talking, I'm thinking Gary Howitt all day long.
Funny story about Gary Howitt. I grew up in Randolph, New Jersey, and he owned a mini putt in Randolph, New Jersey. So when I was growing up, I used to go down, that's where we went to the driving range, and mini putt at Gary Howitt's. And he used to stand up on this counter as like a riser behind it, so he seemed like he was a lot taller than he was, but had all the Stanley Cup pictures behind him and had like the cartoon like murals painted on the mini putt thing outside, and he was gruff as could be.
Nobody screwed around at that mini putt.
I went in there as a kid, like a hockey fan and stuff. I was like, oh man, this is so cool. Yeah, and he would just growl at you. He was intimidating.
Have you ever gone back to watch some of his handiwork? Like, yes. Gary Howitt, yeah. And he was always out of his weight class, yeah. And like handling guys,
yeah.
Big dudes.
He was mean.
Did you ever see him after, you know, you started to play and you became a player?
I wish. No, I never went back. I never seen him since. Just that he had a son that was actually pretty good to play,
yes.
In the area.
Yeah.
But I after I'd made the NHL, I didn't cross paths with him. So maybe he's listening.
I want to ask you this. I want to make sure we get this on the podcast. When Elliot said, hey, we're going to do a sit down with George Parros, I'm like, oh, we got to get this story on because it is one of my favorites. And I don't want to say who told me this because I don't want to embarrass Brad May like that. But can you tell the Cadillac eBay story for our listeners?
This is so funny. You told me you wanted to ask this question. I hadn't thought about it. I love that it's your favorite story. You're one of them anyway.
It's a beautiful one.
It's good. Man, okay, so this was my first year in Anaheim. And I had gotten put on waivers by the Kings after my first year, picked up by Colorado at the start of the next year, my second year in the NHL, and then traded back in a month and a half's time to Anaheim. So I was back in Southern California and happy to be on a team that was already a wagon, already storming through the league, you know, 19 games in. But really excited to be back in Southern California where I'd, you know, been drafted by the Kings and trained there and everything like that. And so when I got back, I had my eye on this car, this 1973 Cadillac Eldorado. My brother and I, we had one. We shared one in high school and college, and it was the best car in the world, just a huge boat. It was mint green with dark green interior.
Oh, yeah.
It was like seafoam green. It was unbelievable. Anyway, I wanted to recapture that, and now I was playing in the NHL. I had some extra money, and I was back in Southern California. I'm like, oh, I'm going to go and try and find a piece of my past here. And so I'd been tracking down this perfect one. It was white on white, and it looked like Boss Hogg's car from Dukes of Hazzard.
Awesome. Yep.
And so I'd taken my time, but finally found this. The perfect Cadillac is decent mileage, decent shape. It was in Oregon. It was a West Coast car. Didn't seem to have much rust on it from what I could tell online on eBay. And so I was with my now wife, and the auction happened to be ending like right during practice. It's towards the end of the year, too. Maybe even playoffs. I think maybe it was even playoffs. Anyway, I was like, man, Tiff, this car's coming up. I've had my eye on it forever, and she knew I had. I go, it's ending during practice, and I need to win this car. So here's what you need to do. You go online and bid. And if I can get off the ice and bid myself, then I'm going to call you, stay near your phone, and I'll call you, and I'll do the bidding. And eBay had just changed over from where you used to be able to see who you're bidding against, and, yep. and they just switched it over. I haven't done eBay probably since in a long time, but I was big in eBay in college. And so anyway, they had just switched over to where you couldn't tell who you were bidding against anymore. And so I go, Tiff, you have to win this car. It's ending, but if I can get off, stay near your phone. I'm going to call you, and I'm going to do it. So I race off after practice. It's a little bit of a shorter practice, which is a rarity in the Randy Carlyle era. But I race off, and I take off my top gear, but I still have my skates and my pants on in the locker room. I'm at the computer, and a couple of guys knew what I was up to. And I race over, and I'm like, oh, great. It hadn't ended yet. So I'm calling my wife, and she is not picking up her phone. And I'm losing my mind now. I called her like 20 times, like an inordinate amount of times. I'm like... And so the whole while I'm starting to bid now because I'm afraid maybe she's not on her phone. Maybe she's not on the computer. I don't know what's going on with her. Maybe she's not there and I got to win this car. So now I'm like just in this frenzy of being so pissed at her. And I'm like, answer your phone. And so sure enough, the bidding keeps ticking up. But I ended up finally being like, okay, I got some faith here. I'm done. And now I've pushed the car past the point of like comfortableness for the price. My comfort range, I'm like, you know what? Like it's right there. I got faith. I'm going to stop. It's got to be her. She's got to be winning it. And sure enough, I get on the phone with her like a little while after. And she's like so excited. Like, yeah, I won the car for you. I'm like, I knew it was you. Why didn't you answer the phone? I ended up paying like a couple grand extra.
And just bidding against
just
each
bidding
other.
Against my wife for like what seemed like an eternity and just swearing through the phone at her and jacked up my own price for a good half hour on eBay. Just this really intense. So anyway, got the car and it arrived a month later and I had it. We won the cup. And so I ended up bringing it to Newport Beach there and had a bunch of the guys piling the car and had the cup in it and everything like that. And became a nice little symbol of winning the cup there. It came at the right time.
And you made someone in Oregon a little bit richer than he thought he was going to become.
100%. I was, and you know, I'm a cheap guy too. So I was just.
Well, your playoff bonus just, really helped for that one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
So you were an eBay guy. Like, what would you, aside from a car, obviously, what other stuff would you buy on eBay?
Oh, man.
For me, it was old Jofa helmets, by the way, on eBay. I was a sucker for old Jofas.
Yeah, and those are expensive, too.
Right? Tell me about
it. Yeah, I bought an old school Nintendo system for college on eBay. I bought... We're getting into the weeds now. I bought a brand new in the box from, like, 1984, like, big wheel. Like the plastic big wheel,
like,
you know?
Like the you ride on with your kids?
I bought it because I thought it was amazing. It was a military police version. It had strobe lights and a PA system on it.
Mm-hmm.
I love big wheels as a kid. I saw this thing, and I'm like, holy cow, this is brand original in the box with a PA system. And I'm like, so I just bought it because it was just like a good deal, and I had to have it, and so I just bought it.
I can
this
respect
is
col- this.
This is college Georgeville. Anyway, so I kept it. And then finally I had kids, you know, all these years later. I was so excited because I'd finally get to have someone use it because I couldn't fit in it, obviously. And I put my kid on like thinking he's going to be like blow his mind. And he like sat in for 2 seconds, just like threw it aside and left. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. It's like 15 years in this thing and didn't pay attention to it.
I was in a store about 2 or 3 months ago and they had this brand new Atari retro set.
Oh, yeah.
Like all their old games. $60 for 64 games.
You bought it,
and,
right?
Oh, Space Invaders, Missile Command, all that stuff. I loved it. I thought my
asteroids?
Kid, yeah, asteroids. Yeah, I thought my kid didn't even care. Yeah. My wife was like, that is just going to sit there and no one's going to use it. And she was totally right.
So
but I was like, I had to have it. I get it.
I understand it.
I'm
with you.
100%.
I'm always curious about ex-hockey players and walking into their house. I've asked Elliot this question before. George, if we walk into your house right now, could we tell that you played in the NHL?
You would not get that sense. No. Well, we move around a lot too. I've just moved, but no, I have memorabilia, tons of it, some great stuff. And I even have an office I could put it all into. I just haven't gotten around to it, I guess. And really haven't been in any one place where this is our forever home type of thing and really dig in. But I do have that cup on the shelf, the little mini cup on the shelf. And that's probably the only indication you'll see right now.
I was going to say then, so the follow-up to that is then, if there was and heaven forbid, if there was ever a fire at your house and you could grab one thing out of your office
what
and
kind
one
of question
thing,
is this?
I asked a bunch of junior kids this once and I got some great answers. And you could only take one thing out of your office. What would it be?
A home office. Well, I would grab my great grandfather's pocket watch. So
that's a good answer.
That's a great answer.
Yeah, that's what I would grab.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's a great answer.
See, now you like the question, Elliot.
See?
Now,
still,
you got a goofy
awful,
hypothetical.
No, it's an awful
getting
question.
Getting good answers from George.
You got bailed out because George's answer
there you
was
go. See?
I knew
I'm
I was,
here to
listen,
help.
I knew where I was mining. I knew I was going to find a nugget there.
So Berkey went back into management. Colin Campbell, he moved off, but he had chances to go into management, decided not to do it. What do you think is your long-term goal here?
You know, it's a good question. I'm going to continue to do this job. If something comes my way, I'll certainly give that all the attention in the world. But I do enjoy this job. It's like I said, it's a super important one. I relish in the fact that, you know, we are trying to preserve this game and do what's best for it. But, you know, I've always wanted to get into management. I think as a kid and playing and everything else, that seems to be an area of great interest for me and has been. So if something like that were to come along, I'd consider it.
Okay, last one for me is, what was the hardest thesis you wrote at Princeton?
Good Lord. Man, that thing was such a burden. But, you know, my senior thesis was an exploration into the longshoremen's labor strike and how it affected different stock prices for companies involved in that industry. And I couldn't tell you, you know, 2 pages of it right now. It sounds very intelligent.
Would you go? What grade did you get?
I got an A. Not even an A minus, a straight A on it, which I was very proud of. Not sure quite how I pulled it off, but that was a lot of long nights all year. They give you that at the beginning of the year. You have a professor that kind of guides you through it, but you're working on that thing almost all year. And it's just, when you hand that thing in, whew.
You're glad it's over.
That's a good day. I mean, the Stanley Cup was a great day. That was a good day, too, though, handing that thing and getting rid of that burden.
And then last one for me. Let's say that next spot is out there for you, George, and you move away from the Department of Player Safety. What's the advice that you would give whomever is next, the new incoming sheriff?
I think just most importantly that you have to, like I said, you have to sleep at night. You have to live with your own decisions. And as long as you feel like you're making the right ones and you can explain yourself to anybody, you can have the confidence to answer the call when people are talking about and picking apart all your decisions, which they will do. And that's the key to it. At the end of the day, that's all it's about. So if you feel like you're making the right decisions for the right reasons and you can back up, and that's going to be your best guiding light.
That's awesome. George, thanks so much for this.
Appreciate it, guys. It was fun.
Is this your first podcast?
My first podcast.
Will it be your last?
Quite possibly, yeah.
Because you peaked early.
That's right.
Actually, the NHL asked me to do podcasts, and I've been pushing it aside for a while, so you guys...
Is that the Batman one?
They're doing an executive series podcast. Yeah. Sadly for you guys, I do tune out the media as much as I can, which is another tenet to this job. I think it's
okay.
Helpful.
It makes
so.
You smarter.
Why did you wait this long to tell a lie on
right?
the podcast, George? Come on. Thanks, George. 31 Thoughts, the podcast, is brought to you by the next generation GMC Sierra Denali, complete with the world's first six-function multi-protocol gate. What's a six-function multi-protocol gate, you ask? Well, it's a cool feature that adapts to whatever you need. It auto-opens from buttons on the key fob, the cockpit, and the tailgate itself. It's got a load stop to prevent long items from sliding out of the cargo box, and turns into a full width step for easy access. An inner gate allows you to insert a platform into the cargo box to create a shelf the two separate items and becomes a work surface with a 12-volt power outlet. So no matter what you're moving or where you're going, the multi-protocol gate gives you options. GMC Sierra Denali. We are professional grade. Yeah, he did like the car story. He really did. That's George Parros, head of the Department of Player Safety in the NHL, enjoying a story about bidding against his then-girlfriend, now-wife, for a car, which they perhaps could, may or may not have been able to afford at that time based on his salary. Listen, I'll tell you what. And he goes out of his way, George does, to mention that these decisions aren't made individually, that they are made as part of a team. And I always do wonder, because, you know, someone like, you know, Damian Echevarrieta.
20 years he's doing that job.
Well, and he goes back to Colin Campbell, too.
Yep.
Like, if there's any one person in that department that I look at, you know, whenever the lead job is available, I always say to myself, why doesn't Damian get this thing?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I always wonder about that because he's seen it all. He's been part of all these conversations.
By the way, can I just say, I'm surprised that teams don't hire guys like Damian or Patrick Burke. If I was a team and in my front office, I'd want that institutional knowledge of the league in my organization.
It's an excellent point.
Especially Damian's been there 20 years, but Patrick, I think, is a really smart guy too. If I was running a team, I would want that insight in my organization.
Well, this sort of winks at the question that I'm going to put to you here now. How much are these positions, whether it's Echevarrieta, whether it's Parros, whether it's Burke, how much of these positions right now are stepping stones to other things? I mean, the obvious one was Brendan Shanahan, who leapfrogged from the position, the Department of Player Safety, into something very significant in the NHL. How much of this is where I'm going to start, but this isn't where I'm going to end?
I just don't know anybody who'd want to do that job anymore for a long time. You know, Parros, as I said, I think he's an interesting guy in the sense that, you know, Berkey is a really emotional guy. Colin Campbell's a really emotional guy. Shanahan and Quintal, I think, were calmer, but, you know, as players, they were emotional guys too. Parros strikes me as maybe being the least emotional out of all of them, and I think that that maybe helps. Like I said, he's got a real good poker face. Like, if you listen to the interview, he's very calm. Like, he rarely, for a guy who did the job that he does, he doesn't really seem to lose his temper a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think that helps. But I don't know anybody, Jeff, who would necessarily want to do that particular job for so long, because you've almost got no allies. And that takes a toll on even the most patient person.
Do you think you need to have played in the NHL to do that job?
I would tend to say yes. I never like to say 100% no, because I do think there's value in having a different perspective in all of this. But, you know, I've said things on the air before when there's an incident and did the guy see a guy? I can't tell if the guy saw the guy. I can't tell what the guy said. And I had a player, former player, now retired, who I always was one of my go-to guys, smartest guys. And he would always say, like, we pretty much know what we're thinking. He says, I know the game's faster now, and that does add for some change, but the people at the NHL, they're the best of the best. You don't think that we kind of know what we're doing?
Mm-hmm.
So I've always remembered that.
Do you think that it's harder for...
Do you buy that, by the way?
I do buy that, and I'll go you one more on it. I'll take that one step further, and I'll say, I think it would be harder in these hearings for a player to BS another player than someone else who never played in the NHL. I think it'd be hard for one player to look another player in the eyes and say, no, what I was really trying to do was this.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can do that. Like, if I'm the head of the Department of Player Safety and I'm talking to Brad Marchand in a hearing, he can BS me all day long.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm Zdeno O'Chara, who's head of the Department of Player Safety, I don't think he can.
Yes. And, you know, Ray Whitney is there now. Like, again, we've talked about Damian and Patrick. If they ever handed them the job, because they've been there for so long, I think they could probably do it. But I do think, like I said, that there are former players who say to me sometimes, we know what we're doing.
You know, there was a feeling, and this is much like the salary cap in 2005, the minute, you know, the players capitulated and went salary cap, that it was going to put player against player.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that play out. When Brendan Shanahan was named the head of the Department of Player Safety, there was a lot of, hang on, how can an ex-player do this to a current player? how can an ex-player take money out of a current player's pocket? Do you think that still exists? That players still will look at George Parros and say, hey, man, you played. Why are you making me write a check?
Well, I believe that could happen. I don't know how many times it happens. But ultimately, my reaction to that is, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. Like, it's probably your fault that you're putting yourself in this situation.
You just know how the fraternity of players yes. works, and like, but let's not cost anyone a dime here.
I don't like that way of thinking, and I would like to think that I would never think that way.
But you know that it happened more so under Shanahan yes. originally than
because
perhaps
Brendan
it does happen
in,
now.
Brendan went in like firing. We went from no suspensions to big suspensions, yeah. and people were like, what? That was the thing. Like, Brendan went in there and he said, I'm going to be different, and he was. Yeah. And there was pushback, yes. But again, like, I've never believed in that kind of thinking. Like, again, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime.
Final thought on George Parros?
You know, I always remembered him winning the cup.
Yes.
And we talked about it in that, about how he was the calmest looking guy, like you almost couldn't tell. I think when you're in that kind of job, that's the comportment you need to have. You need to be wired that way. How can I avoid the emotional roller coaster? How can I be as close to flatline as possible? And I think that gives you the best chance to be successful in that job.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed the George Parros interview as much as we enjoyed talking to him. In a couple of weeks, you'll hear from the chief content officer of the NHL, and that is Steve Mayer. I loved doing this. Not just, Elliot, because I could pitch my goofy ideas for goofy TV shows to him, but I really didn't know a whole lot about the position and what it entailed. What, in your words, can people look forward to in this piece coming up in a couple of weeks?
You know what? I just think it's a really good interview. I think people are going to be really interested in hearing what he has to say about where the league is going and marketing the players. I really like that interview.
And you really enjoyed my ideas for TV shows?
You know, the fact that he didn't look at you like you were bat crazy, I think is a real testament to him.
The fact that he didn't look at me like I'm bat crazy means he's heard even goofier yes, ideas, yes, but wasn't going to betray them. Thanks for joining us on 31 Thoughts, the podcast. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. You don't think they're just out of gas?
I think the goalie might have been. He admitted it.
He did. Vasilevsky
but, you know,
did, yeah.
I think the toughest thing is going to be...
Uh-oh. He's got a doubleheader tonight, too. We'll just end on one last question. Do you think they're bored?
I do. You know, the goalie admitted he was tired. One more time. Take six. Thank you very much. Yeah, you sure.
End of the year outtakes. Feed your sneezing fit. Oh, great.
That's a 6X.
Oh.
Yeah. Thank you. Like that every year. When it comes, it comes in waves. Oh my god.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you. Okay, I'm good.
Good.
Right. And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
Letting the days go by, let the water hold me down. Letting the days go by, water flowing underground into the blue again. After the money's gone, once in a lifetime, water flowing underground.
And you may ask yourself, how do